in 1968, and one of the country regions that I think a lot of us know about it, probably said it to you publicly, is in 1968, the state had what was called the Alaska Land Mass Task Force, which was established by the governor, tabled at the time, and it was paid for a lot of the meetings that we had. Task force for the state level, where there's a lot of travel, really helped in enabling groups of discuss the climate issue. And also during 1968, in the midst of the, there was a government study done, and the large group that's called the Alaska Natives in the Land came out of things like the basic government study that the fourth was that our land for valid. One thing that helped the claim settlement to be pursued to very successful land. Thank you very much.
Their efforts and land claims and how they participated in the AFN. But before we do that, let me tell you a little bit about John Holt. When we first got started, we'd have a big meeting like this, and sometimes those meetings would run at 11 o'clock for 3 days in a row. And there were very hot arguments going on, and motions from the floor, and motions to table, and motions to amend, and motions to divide the question. And not being a parliamentarian, it used to make my head swim. But I never went into a meeting if I could help it without having John Hope at my side as my parliamentarian. Didn't take me very long to learn to rule somebody out of order, because it took a two-thirds vote to overturn the ruling of the chair. And it took a half hour to unscramble the, take the votes, the results of that, so it gave us time to collect our thoughts and get things going again. But John has a very distinguished career in the Native movement. He's been past president of the Alaska Native Brotherhood. He's on the board of directors of Sea Alaska Corporation. He's now president of the Clinton Haida Central Council, and before him, his father was a very distinguished mover in southeastern Alaska. So I'm very happy to give you John Holt.
Treaties were fine, and the Indians kept members, and those members treated begin an annoyance to the dominant society. And the native people, those tolerated people that came to our country, but there were a lot of things they were doing to us, and the A&D was organized to overcome those various problems that were created by government. I guess we wouldn't have signed all those treaties if we realized that we knew in advance they were very prolific on the other side and increased in numbers much more rapidly than we counted them. I'm going to have to tell you when to laugh. I think that was a photograph. Well, it was an effort at humor. Okay. The A&D began to address those things, and the people that organized A&D were predominantly from the Sitka Training School in Sitka. And in 1912, they went to Juneau to formalize their organization. They met in a hotel room in Juneau in 1912, and they elected their first officer. They had a very successful meeting. The first convention of Grand Theft A&D was held in a small little cavern. There were 13 of the original organizers, and they conducted the business for our people. In 1918, Mr. William Hall, who was a very eminent attorney, returned to Alaska, and he told me he came up just like we do nowadays. He was pursuing a better life, more education. He was down south. He had already had his law degree. But he came up to fish so he could do a little bit more and go back down south. But while he was up here, his team didn't turn out as well as he planned, and his brother Louis Paul talked to him at great length about the need for his type of leadership. In 1918, we didn't have very many Native lawyers. In 1981, we don't have any Native lawyers. William Hall was prevailed upon to stay in Alaska. He was a remarkable person. He was a good orator. He was a good thespian. He wanted to be a preacher. He wanted to go back and study to be a preacher. He wanted to be a metropolitan opera singer. He was a very good tenor in his younger days. He was a brilliant man, very brilliant man. And he made parliamentarians out of a lot of us because we were on the other side of the issue many times. In order for us to get our side to prevail, we had to understand parliamentary law. And in order to do that, you had to compete against a very brilliant man. And many of us learned our parliamentary procedure because William Paul was a very active man, a very aggressive man, a very persuasive man. In the early 1920s, William Paul talked with Peter Simpson. Peter Simpson was a Simpson man who migrated from Old Metlakatla. Old Metlakatla is in British Columbia. He migrated to New Metlakatla with Father Duncan's first group of Simpson Indians. And he couldn't speak English, and he couldn't speak Tlingit. And he came to Sitka Training School, and he said he came on a boat and they had to march up to the school together. And they were marching the orders in English, and he didn't understand English. And the other people were conversing in Tlingit, and he could understand that. So it turned out to be what we call in Southeast Alaska, the father of the A&D. A very, very dedicated man to the organization. And all the early leaders of the A&D movement were in fact very, very dedicated and made great personal sacrifices. It wasn't like today where none of us build anywhere unless somebody else pays our way. They not only have to pay our way, they have to make sure we have something to eat and a place to sleep. That's the kind of thing that we are in this day. But those early leaders were not like us. They dug into their pockets, they believed in causes, and they made personal sacrifices, great personal sacrifices. Peter Simpson graduated from Sheldon Jackson. In those days, you got to the fourth grade and you graduated. And one of the great tragedies, as far as William Paul was concerned, is when we were prevailing upon a territory of Alaska, when our children could go to their public schools, the territory of Alaska got very generous and said, certainly you can enter our schools, but you must enter at the sixth grade level. And our education in the missionary schools concluded at the fourth grade. So effectively, we were not able to get into those schools. Peter Simpson came to William Paul in the early 1920s. And he said, the first thing he said that I heard William Paul tell me was, the only land you have is 6 by 6 by 4. And you don't get that until it's all over. And then the other thing he said is, this is your land, why don't you fight for it? And he said that in 1925. And that got William Paul thinking about it. In those days, we as a people wanted very, very much to be citizens. We thought that the way to go for all of our people was to adopt the new culture that was moving in. And one of the real things that was a goal of ours was citizenship and participating in society. And when there was a suggestion, and it was just an informal suggestion, that we sue the government for our land, and a lot of our people said, hey, you can't do that. You can't do that. This will make us second-class citizens. There was a lot of resistance to taking legal action against the United States for the land as we do to be ours. There was a lot of people discussing these things, and I'm fine that we did enter a suit. In 1929, the A&D had a name. Every year the A&D meets in one of the villages or one of the cities. 1929, they met the name. Judge Wickersham had retired as a delegate to Congress. We didn't have senators, and we didn't have representatives. We had what was called a delegate to Congress. Alaska elected one person and sent him to Congress to look after our interests. That person did not have a vote. He was a delegate to Congress. Judge Wickersham was such an individual, and he was an attorney. William Paul invited him to the 1929 Haines Convention on the land in question. Judge Wickersham explained to the delegates the process that they would have to go through if they were to initiate a suit. The A&D Grand Camp created a committee of five to meet with Judge Wickersham. The convention itself asked Judge Wickersham a number of questions. And then they were persuaded that maybe they ought to do this, they ought to sue the government. And so a committee of five was created. They met further with Judge Wickersham, and a resolution was passed at that convention authorizing their representatives to approach Congress, to persuade Congress that they have a legitimate case, and that there should be a suit initiated against the United States government for land lost. That was passed at the 1929 convention and was entered in Congress. In 1935, the House of Representatives did pass what's been called the Jurisdictional Act. This allowed the Pecunada people to sue the government for the land that were taken from them. However, it was very difficult to obtain an attorney. Attorneys in land and judgment cases have to put the bill themselves. They have to put the money up front. They have to believe in your case to the point where they will spend their own monies, and then when they win their case, they will recover their money. And in the early days of Indian litigation, a lot of attorneys got very wealthy. And then Congress said that we ought to put a lid on this. And so later on in time, Congress said that any attorney prosecuting a judgment case for a tribe could not receive more than 10% of the award. They could receive up to 10% of the award. And the suit was filed. Well, the attorney could not be found. The suit wasn't filed, by the way. The attorney could not be located that would take our case. And the law that allowed us to sue the government would lapse in 7 years. It was a 7-year authority in which we had 7 years as a tribe to enter our case in court. The period almost lapsed in A&B in 1939 in Sitka. Asked Congress if they would extend the jurisdictional act another 5 years while they looked for an attorney. And meanwhile, they did get attorney Jim Curry of Washington, D.C., consented to take the case. He had a lot of difficulties and was not able to make much headway. And ultimately, he sold his interest to Winthrop and Winthrop. And they were a very experienced company, legal firm. And they had a very good track record, and in 1947 they did issue our case in the Court of Claims of the United States. In 1958, the Court of Claims said, yes, in fact, we did, as a tribe, own the land. There were a lot of things that happened in between that time. The A&B would be on an annual basis. In 1935, the A&B allowed the Pickett and Hyder to meet. They had a wrangle, and not much happened. In 1941, again, Pickett and Hyder had a wrangle. This time, the Bureau of Indian Affairs put a bill. At that time, they organized. In 1941, they organized a wrangle, and the delegates were pretty much on the same order as the A&B. Almost identical. They almost had three of each community, which is the A&D my dad, his name was Andrew Hope, was a delegate to that convention. But unfortunately, he became ill, and I was reading the minutes of that convention. He was confined to the only hotel in Wrangell. I don't know why that happened, because in our society, we didn't stay in hotels. We stayed at the hosting communities where they provided us residence. Usually the host would provide somewhere for us to stay. But I noticed in a minute that Mr. Andrew Hope, my dad, stayed in a hotel. He had laryngitis. He couldn't talk. All during this very, very crucial and important convention, he couldn't talk. He got elected president. I can see now why I failed my first three times. He was re-elected for 25 successive years and served as president of Lincoln and Ida until 1966. Ted Denny was elected. My dad was feeling a little bit ill. He died a few years later of cancer. The suit was ultimately won in 1958. He started the action in 1929. This is a judicial settlement. We won our case in 1958, but we didn't know how much money it was worth. We as a tribe thought a losses would be $88 million. Think by using it on time. This is just a preamble. there was a further proceeding to determine a worth for the land. And when you think of judicial settlement, you have to get compensated for the value of the land at the time of the taking. So if they weren't harvesting any timber, they were harvesting only hemlock in our country, and they were using it only for trap and piling. And it was something like 5 cents a board foot or something. Does that sound right, Charlie? I don't know the terminology. ridiculously low. And so we have to take the value at the time of the taking. And they created Glacier Bay National Monument in 1912. Whatever it was worth in 1912, that's what they paid it. And each of the takings were individual. The creation of the city of Juneau, whenever that was taken, what it was worth at that time is what becomes confiscated. So the millions of dollars that went out of Southeast didn't mean anything. We had to settle for the value of the land at the time of the taking. We said we thought we had coming to us $88 million. The ultimate settlement was $7.5 million. And in 1968, they awarded the $7.5 million. And the thing is not about the Juneau, whether they even want to accept that, because we were expecting $88 million. The attorney said, well, the one remaining portion of the settlement that is not settled is the fisheries. The court of claims says you don't have anything coming from the fisheries. We thought that was our greatest loss. And the attorney said, we can appeal this, but your chances are 20% of your success. In view of both decisions, I think maybe you might be wrong. Anyway, the delegates debated whether they should accept $7.5 million in 1968. And there was a suggestion to the delegates that maybe they ought to utilize some of that money and help the AFN, which was just getting started, make some of those monies available to a larger land claims effort. And so a decision was made to accept the $7.5 million. Anybody take a guess at how much we have left? The last report we got on our printout shows we have $7.5 million. Pretty good, huh? Please welcome. We did then begin participating with the AFN. Through a long series of struggles, there was a suggestion by some of the leadership that we take our suit on an individual clan basis. We're organized down there by clan. And some clans have very valuable land, and other clans do not have land of equal value. Annually, there was a debate whether we should take a settlement on a clan basis on a client basis, or whether we should all share and share alike. And the A&D Grand Camp's position was everyone should share equally no matter what his land might be worth. And every year that same issue would be raised, and every year same result. The A&D position would prevail. And so that continued all the way until the settlement and the debate at that time narrowed down to, I think, the only legal point that was not pursued, at least from the perspective of Mr. Willie Paul, he said the Thailand issue has not been addressed. He said we still have Thailand, we ought to sue for that. But his kind of leadership is no longer there, whether he was right or wrong. I have no way of knowing. So the involvement of the A&D has been tremendous. It moved on into Hackett and Haida. There was somewhat of a separation between the two organizations for a time. It seems at this period in time that the A&D, Hackett and Haida, and Sea Alaska are really working together very, very well. Because now Sea Alaska has created a heritage foundation in which they say one of those seats must go, one of the board seats must go to the Grand Camp A&D. One of the seats on that board must go to the Lincoln Island Central Council. And the other seats are some from the Sea Alaska board and talks about interested individuals. So moving from the position of the AMD, one of the interesting points that I didn't mention was the AMD said that this was our student, this is an AMD student, and they call it land student. The old people would talk about the land student, and then it was the land student committee. AMD insisted that they would continue to fund this until 1949, when the Interior Department said, AMD, you have to move out of this case. This is a tribal settlement. AMD is an organization that doesn't have 100% tribal membership among the Lincoln Highlands people. Its membership is a broader-based membership, and it is not a tribal organization. And the AMB then gracefully withdrew and created the Lincoln Highlands Central Council. And Central Council met, as I told you, annually from 1935. They weren't too faithful in the first few years, but from 1941 to the present day, they do meet on an annual basis, electing their officers. The presidency is a two-year term. I have served 1 year and now begin the second year. So that should give you kind of a broad overview on how the AMB evolved and where the Lincoln Highlands came from, and how the Alaska arrived on the scene. Thank you very much.
Thank you, John. We had a great debate. We talked about Lincoln Highlands. And the debate was, we're going to let you in or not. The argument was that you already have a settlement, and if we've tried to get you weak in our case. Anyway, it was a close vote. And it was a 12-12 vote. We had to cast a tie-breaking vote that let you guys in. In the mid-60s, a number of things came together to make it necessary and possible for us to organize AFN. The state of Alaska was selecting land, miners were getting patents, people were getting homesteads, oil exploration was going on, all without regard to Native concerns or without considering what rights in land Native people might have. AFN was lucky to have the support of the Taiwanese people during our early years. They supported us in three ways. The young chief, who was no longer with us, Albert Koloa, gave us all the support he could. Their attorney, Stanley McCutcheon, gave us valuable advice, and they gave generously of their money. Today, Agnes Brown, who is president of the village, president of the statewide village association, will tell us of their efforts and contribution. Agnes?
Thank you, Emil. A lot of you already know the story, but there's some new faces in the audience. Nice to see the younger generation coming along. Just yesterday, I thought I was the younger generation. About 1964, the Secretary of Interior decided to have some oil and gas be sales on what was then the Mokwaki Indian Reservation, known as Taiwanese. There were to be two oil and gas be sales. This went forward without any consultation with the people who lived in the village. And of course, there was great concern. We still then had the tribal chief custom. The village council really still operates today, although we don't still have the tribal chief. people got together and wondered what they should do. Earlier in time, Stanley McCutcheon was a young pilot, and I think it was like once a month we used to get our mail thrown in. And so people remembered that Stanley was a very nice person, very caring about the people of Chionic, good close friend of Chief Simeon Chickalushin. And I think he had some emotional feelings towards my oldest sister. At any rate, they remembered that he could help them, and he was an attorney. They got in touch with him, and his response was prompt. He filed a lawsuit on behalf of the village against the government. In very short order, that